Chapters 9 and 10, I mentioned last week that the MP3 for August 8th covers Lonergan talking on that material, on chapters 9 and 10. And then for chapter 11, which we may get to at least in an initial stage this week, the MP3 for August 9th part 1, August 9th part 1, corresponds to the material on Insight chapter 11. Greg has asked me to remind you that he has MP3s, the second MP3 for those of you who haven't picked it up yet. He brought some of it today. So if you are interested in getting that second round of MP3s, you can see him at the break or after class. All right, so we go back then to chapters 9 to 11, and we'll take the material. Well, we got to only the first page and a couple of items on page 2, so let me run briefly through the material from that's on the first page. This is the material on judgment in chapter 9. So when we get to judgment, we're talking about a third level of cognitional activity. There's the level of presentations or experience, the empirical level. Then we're promoted, consciousness is promoted to an intelligent level of consciousness by raising questions for understanding. And that second level is in shorthand called the level of understanding. But what happens at that second level is questions for intelligence, insight into image or into sensible presentation, and conceptualization and formulation. And then, so that's largely what we have seen in the first 8 chapters of the book, the various relationships between the empirical and the intelligent level of consciousness, because there are different kinds of insight. There are explanatory insights, such as in science, and there are descriptive insights in ordinary, everyday common sense. All right, so now we're moving to a third level, judgment. And judgment is sparked by the question for reflection. Is it so? And then from the question for reflection, there's a grasp of evidence. And from the grasp of evidence, there flows yes, no, maybe, probably, whatever it might be, depending on the evidence grasped. So being reasonable, there's an imperative. Lonergan, in his later work after Insight, attaches what he calls a transcendental imperative or a transcendental precept to each of the levels of consciousness. So be attentive, be intelligent. And that doesn't mean have a high IQ. It means raise questions and ask about your experience. Be reasonable. Third level. And being reasonable is keeping your judgments, yes, no, maybe, probably, in accord with the evidence grasped. That's what it is to be reasonable. And we all tend, in one form or another, to veer from that. We can either be rash or we can be indecisive. And you'll see some of that as we go along here today. And then, of course, there's a fourth level decision, which we won't get to until chapter 18, but be responsible. That's the imperative for the fourth level. Be intelligent, be reasonable, be responsible. If you were going to do a transposition of natural law theory on the basis of Lonergan, well, this is the way the transposition would take. This would be the fundamental element in the natural law. Because this is who we are. We are structured this way, and that's our nature, and that's what it is to follow the law of our nature, is to be attentive, be intelligent, be reasonable, be responsible. Okay, anyway, the first determination of judgment, as we saw last week, is that judgment is not simply considering a proposition, but taking a stand with regard to it, assenting to it, or refusing to assent, disagreeing. And the second determination is that judgment answers the question for reflection, And the third determination is that there's a kind of personal commitment. The person, you as a person, as a subject, your authenticity, your integrity, is more on the line when you get to the level of judgment, when you've raised that question, is it true, than when you're at this level. You can reflect, you can ponder and consider and play conceptual games at this level until you're blue in the face. Okay? But when the issue is the issue of truth, then there's more of a demand on you to keep your judgments in accord with the evidence grasp. There's something there about the character of the person that's at stake that is far more significant for who we are, for our existential stance, than the second one. Okay, so there's that third determination, the personal commitment. We have responsibility for our judgments in a way that is far beyond the responsibility we have for just thinking about things. You know? But ultimately, we need to take a stand on a lot of issues. Anyway. So its relation then to the structure of cognitional process, number 5 on page 1. While this level presupposes the empirical level, the level of intelligence also is presupposed and complemented by the third level, the level of reflection and judgment. Every answer to a question for intelligence evokes or raises a further question for reflection, is it so? Revealing the ulterior motive in our cognitive process. We conceive the ulterior motive behind conceiving and defining, thinking and considering, and so on. Namely, we conceive in order to judge. We want to know, and we're not knowing yet when we're simply conceiving, when we're simply thinking about things. And here, then, there emerge the notions of truth and falsity, certitude, and the probability that is not a frequency, but a quality of judgment, probably. Okay? And we'll see more about that today. And also here, the personal commitment that makes one responsible for one's judgments. The schema we don't have to look at again, we saw that last week. And then this is as far as we got last week, number 6 on this page, the three levels of cognitional process operating in two modes, on the data of sense and on the data of consciousness. So I can attend to data of sense, understand data of sense, and judge that I have understood the data of sense correctly. But I can also attend to my own experiencing, understanding, and judging. I can understand that my experience, understanding, and judging in their relations to one another. And I can affirm that I have understood correctly the relations of experiencing, understanding, and judging to one another. So I can bring the operations of experiencing, understanding, and judging to bear on the operations of experiencing, understanding, and judging. Experiencing, understanding, and judging is the subject as subject. But if I turn those operations on themselves and experience, understand, judge my experiencing, understanding, and judging, then the subject as object emerges. I take up, I objectify myself. So there's a subject as subject, and the subject is object. Now there's a lot of important considerations around the relationship between the subject as subject and the subject as object, which we can get into more as the course goes on, because these two can never be coincident. There's never an absolute identity between the subject as subject and the subject as object. Because the subject as object is not capturing the subject who's doing the objectifying. Okay? So I can turn the tables on my experiencing, understanding, and judging, but as I do that, there's the subject that's doing it, and the subject that's doing it is not quite the same as the subject that's being objectified. They're not quite coincident with one another. I've had a suspicion, for those of you who are into postmodern literature, that discrepancy, this is just from a little bit of reading of Derrida, but he says something along those lines, that we never achieve this total identity in reflection, and that's behind a lot of his notion of the trace and so on, I think. He would make more of he makes it more of a problematic issue than Lonergan simply accepting the fact that the subject is object never completely captured, is never completely captured by the subject is object. Now, I may be wrong in my reading of Derrida, but that is in some of his early writing. It seems to be fueled by the non-identity, the ultimate non-identity of reflective, a reflective grasp with the one that's made the actual operator. That we never have complete self-knowledge, and we won't, short of the vision of God. We will not know ourselves completely. But there is that. We can do a certain amount of objectification, and in chapter 11, Lonergan will be arguing that we can make some true judgments about the subject, so that some of our objectification of who we are, it can be true judgments about who we are. And he will try to evoke one true judgment in you in chapter 11. Am I clear on the distinction of subject? Yeah, it's one way of coming at what he's talking about here in number 6. Okay, I don't have to read through number 6 because we saw that last week, unless you've got any questions about it. We can move on to the material otherwise. All right, number 7. This analysis of bringing the operations of experiencing, understanding, and judging to bear on experiencing, understanding, and judging yields to synthesis. The contents of several acts are unified into a single known content. So, just quoting from page 300 here, contents of different acts. So, let's say seeing, questioning, understanding, reflecting, judging. The content is different in each of those. Seeing, the content of seeing is not the same as the content of understanding. And the content of understanding, something's added. But the contents of different acts come together, inasmuch as the earlier are incomplete without the later, while the later have nothing to complete without the earlier. Questions for intelligence, in between experiencing and understanding, presuppose something to be understood, and that something is supplied by the initial level. Understanding grasps in given or imagined presentations an intelligible form emergent in the presentations, so that what is sensed yields to an intelligibility. Conception formulates the grasped idea along with what is essential to the idea in the presentations. I'll come back to that sentence in a moment. Conception formulates the grasped idea along with what is essential to the idea in the presentations. Reflection, is it so, asks whether such understanding and formulation are correct. Judgment answers that they are or are not. All right, so he's analyzed that all out, but now he's saying it all comes together to give you one or not. Object, whether that's a thing or a state of affairs or a law or whatever, they're all coming together, synthesis. Now, that section on conception there is stated very quickly in Insight, and he explains that a little more in Understanding Being. Conception formulates the grasped idea along with what is essential to the idea in the presentations. He gives an example here. Conception, so the concept again, so we're talking about something that happens at the second level, expresses generally what is essential to having the insight, and that's a matter of abstraction. So he goes back to the circle here to give you the example. You pick out from these particular radii and this particular case of perfect roundness everything that is necessary and nothing that is not necessary to have the insight again. In other words, you select what's essential and omit what is incidental. You select what's relevant and omit what is irrelevant. You select what is significant and omit what is negligible. So if I could draw a perfect circle on this board, and I can't, so I'm not even going to try. But it would make no difference if the board were green or white or black. And so you don't bring that along with you into the conception of what it is that makes a circle a circle. It makes no difference what the color of the chalk is or how big the circle is in terms of grasping what is a circle. It doesn't make any difference how big it is, what color it is. But there has to be a center, a perimeter, and equal radii of any size in any position, and the center, the perimeter, and the radii have to be in the same plane. So you bring those along from the presentations into the understanding and into the conception. You bring along what's necessary to grasp, to have the insight. But not everything comes along. Not everything moves along. The color doesn't matter. The size doesn't matter. In his later work, this will be a matter of sublation. Okay, he'll talk about sublation. But understanding sublates experience. It leaves behind what isn't essential for the understanding, and it sublates the rest of it into a higher level. Judgment sublates understanding to truth. Decision sublates knowledge into action. So the notion of sublation. Taking along whatever is essential and enriching it by moving it to a new and higher level and leaving behind what's incidental, what doesn't matter. Number eight then. The judgment has both a proper content. The proper content of judgment is the answers, yes or no. That's the inner word that judgment is. Okay? Judgment is the inner word of yes or no or maybe or probably or whatever. That's the proper content of judgment. Okay? Whereas the proper content of understanding is whatever has been grasped by insight, the intelligibility, the whatness. Medievals had that awful word quiditas. They took the Latin word quid and they made a noun out of it, quiditas, the whatness. Okay? That's the proper content of understanding. But the proper content of judgment is the yes or no. But also there's a borrowed content. There's a direct borrowed content in the question to which the yes or no is the answer. Is this true? This intelligible? Is that accurate? So that becomes part of the borrowed content of the judgment. And then there's an indirect borrowed content, yes, certainly, or yes, I think so, or yes, probably, the tone of the judgment, whether it's you're certain about it or you're not certain, you're saying, well, it looks like it. Okay? It's all in terms of what the grasp of the evidence is. So he gives the example. The direct borrowed content of the judgment, I am writing, is the question, am I writing? The proper content of that judgment is the answer, yes, I am. The indirect borrowed content is the implicit meaning, it certainly is true that I am writing. Okay. Now those may seem like fine distinctions, but he wants to make sure that he covers all the bases. He says in the introduction that if you're building a ship, you've got to go all the way with it, or otherwise it's going to sink. And so, a lot of times you'll see Lonergan saying, oh, Bernard, for heaven's sake, what are you going into all of that for? Well, he wants to make sure that he's covered as many relevant questions as he was able to think of. So that's why you get all these distinctions at times. Okay? So number nine, and this is an important point, the judgment is the total increment in cognitional process. Once you have reached a true judgment and know that you have judged truly, you have added something to your knowledge. That's what he means by the total increment. A true judgment is a complete increment in cognitional process. The last act in a given cognitional process, it doesn't mean you stop knowing, but it means that on this question, you've reached the truth. Okay, we'll see later on just what that means. But it is the act that brings to a close one whole step in the development of knowledge. And when you get to the point where you assent to something and you know that you have the evidence for assenting to it, then you have completed one step in the growth of your knowledge. Every element in that process is at least a partial increment. It makes some contribution to knowing. But the judgment is the last act in the series that begins from presentations and advances through understanding and formulation, ultimately to reach reflection and affirmation or denial. Thus, the proper content of judgment, the yes or no, is the final partial increment in the process. But this proper content is meaningless apart from the question it answers. With the question, it forms an integrated whole. But the question takes over a formulation from the level of intelligence, a and that formulation draws upon both insight and presentation. It follows that the judgment as a whole is a total increment in cognitional process, that it brings to a close one whole step in the development of knowledge. Now, what we need to do to grasp this is to think of the difference between, in a given instance in our own experience, the difference between considering something at this level and assenting to it at this level. So to try to call up something from your own experience, that you've been wrestling with a problem, whether it's in practical everyday living, or whether it's a theoretical problem, or a philosophic problem, scientific, or whatever. But for a long time you're saying, I don't know, I'm not sure, and so on and so forth. And then all of a sudden it all comes together, and you know that you've got the evidence that is sufficient for this, for yes or no to emerge. There's a new inner word that has emerged at that point. Even if you don't say yes or no, there's something, there's a settling that comes. The issue is settled. The case is closed. Idealism misses this in accounting for human knowing. It misses the difference between judgment and understanding. It collapses judgment into understanding. Or it says, depending on who it is, that you can't make any judgments until you know everything about everything. And what Lonergan is saying is you don't have to know everything about everything to know this is a table. I don't have to know everything about everything to assent to the judgment, this is a table, or this is a desk, whatever word you want to use for. But this is not the floor. That's a true judgment, and I don't need to know everything about it to assent to that. There's a difference between the understanding all interrelation. I've got to understand how everything is related to everything else before I can say this is not the floor. I don't. There can be these partial increments or these total increments in partial statements. Okay, one little piece of knowledge. And it's different. It's different from this level. The idealist will collapse everything into this level. The empiricist will not acknowledge either of these two levels. Will say that the only thing we really know is what we sense, and all of this is merely subjective activity, intelligibility, judgment. So you've got there's three different cognitional theories related to the three levels of knowing. There's empiricism, which takes its criterion from the empirical level. There's idealism, which basically is all we know are our own ideas. And there's realism, which distinguishes judgment from understanding and assents the yes or the no. And as he'll go on to say, that it's in those judgments that we know being. And being is the real. These are later things that will come along. But, and the realism is a critical realism because it has passed through understanding. We only know in a human way, in fully human knowing, what we have understood. To pass judgment, Lonergan has in one phrase, one sentence, or I think it's either cognitional structure or dimensions of meaning. To pass judgment upon what one does not understand is not human knowledge, but human arrogance. So, a judgment that flows out of understanding, he'll call an epistemology or cognitional theory that acknowledges judgment flowing out of understanding. We on the same page so far. Any questions, Cora?
Is this the place for? Because I can't think of what's naive realism.
Naive realism is the Lonergan says the naive realist knows the real world and makes judgments. But if you ask the naive realist for the criterion, he or she will go to this level to give you the criteria. I took a good look. Rather than grasping the evidence for something grasped and understood. So the naive realist, in terms of an example of a person that Lonergan, whose cognitional theory is naive realism, it would be Etienne Gilson. He's a great historian, and as a historian, he's unmatched in terms of doing a history of Christian philosophy, Augustine and the Middle Ages, and so on. Incredibly rich. But his whole thing was, we see being, you know, and you don't see being, you see color. You judge being, you know being in judgment. You don't know it by taking a look, not as being. That's the difference. So it's not a matter of seeing. And if it were a matter of seeing, then how can you validate the affirmation that something like E equals MC squared is probably true, because it's been verified indirectly and directly over and over and over again, or Galileo's law of falling bodies. You don't see that law. You don't see that there is a proportionality between time and distance. But you can affirm that after experiment after experiment after experiment. It's verified. So you can affirm that it's probably true. But the naive realist epistemology cannot account for that. And that's why the epistemology that I learned in St. Louis, which was Gilsonian Thomism, scientific knowledge was all simply constructional. Whereas we metaphysicians know the real world. And the scientist knows only the world that they've constructed. You see the difference?
Yeah. Yes,
we know the real world because we see being. Well, I don't see being. I see you, but I don't know. I don't know by seeing that you are being. I know that by judging. That's the difference. Not by seeing.
This precept, be reasonable.
Yeah.
So I'm not getting ahead. It's just as reasonable not to make a judgment as it is to make a judgment.
That's right. It is. It's just as reasonable. And in fact, if the evidence is not in, then you've got to withhold. Or if you haven't grasped it yet, it's a matter of your own. You know, I mean, sometimes you're in a discussion with somebody and you say, well, you may see it, but I don't see it yet. So I'm withholding judgment until I've got it. So that's being reasonable. Unless you trust the other person so much that you believe. And there are grounds for that. And there are, when he gets into the analysis of belief, he will say that, you know, in many instances it's reasonable to believe the testimony of someone else. You don't really know unless you've been there, you don't really know the relative position of Afghanistan and Iraq to one another. You don't know that because you haven't experienced that. You believe the map makers. You trust them. That's a matter of belief. And but, you know, if we didn't do that, we'd have to start all over again every day. The scientist who experiments with things today has not personally gone through every experiment that's been performed in his or her science, so that they know from personal experience, understanding, and judgment that this is the case. They believe, they trust their predecessors, and they trust the integrity of their work until a problem arises, and then they've got maybe do some revisions. But so belief plays a tremendous role, and it is reasonable generally to believe that Cardinal Newman. And Lonergan quotes him to this effect. I think he said this before he was a cardinal, so that makes it more valid. But it's more reasonable to believe everything than to doubt everything. And then cut away the stuff that's nonsense. But at least you've got something. But if you're doubting everything, you've got nothing. So it's much better to, and it's the same as St. Ignatius's precept at the beginning of the exercises, to trust the integrity of your dialogue partner is a much better way, until it's evident that you can't. But start out by trusting and then make adjustments if you have to, instead of suspecting everybody. Okay, contexts is the next issue, context. All judgments occur within context. And this will become a central hermeneutical aspect. He's not getting into the hermeneutic issue yet until chapter 17. But in many instances, we have to grasp the context in which a judgment emerges in order to know what the judgment is, or to understand somebody else's judgment. We have to know the context in which he or she spoke it. But what Lonergan is talking about here are just the most general aspects of the context. I didn't proofread this particular set of notes, and I found several things going over. It should be just the most general aspects of the context in which judgments occur are logic and dialectic, or perhaps better, method. I think in his later writing he would have said logic and method rather than logic and dialectic. Logic is the effort of knowledge to attain the coherence and organization proper to any state of its development, or any stage. Perhaps probably that word should probably be stage. I just noticed that right now. Logic is the effort that we make to be coherent at any stage. And if there's an incoherence, then what he here calls dialectic, or what he will later call method rests on the breakdown of those efforts to attain coherence and organization at a given stage, and consists in bringing to birth a new stage in which logic, again, will endeavor to attain coherence and organization. So this is a recurrent theme in Lonergan's thinking, is the relationship between logic and method. There are schools of cognitional theory that place a premium upon logic. Lonergan does not. Logic's role is to put organization into what you currently know. Method is much more important. Method is what you appeal to when you can't do that, when there are inconsistencies, and when your efforts to achieve coherence have broken down and you've got to go back to the drawing boards and start all over again. And method is basically experience, understanding, and judging, some of which is not logical. It's intelligent and reasonable, but not logical. Not all of our cognitive operations are logical operations. Grasping insight, a flash of insight, is not logical. Okay, it's a leap. No leaps are logical. Logic is very precise and, you know, major, minor conclusion, that sort of thing. Leaps of intelligence are non-logical but extremely intelligent operations. He says in Philosophy of God and Theology that the logician is like the mortician, because the logician achieves a steady state only temporarily, and then it falls apart, and then you've got to start all over and move to a new steady state, like 6 feet under. Okay, so the most general aspects are logic and method. This revision that method brings about does have its limits, and we'll see this as we get into chapter 11, perhaps today, but more likely next week, because there is no revision of revisers themselves. And what he means by that is that ultimately you're back to experiencing, understanding, and judging. And you can't revise that without appealing to experience, saying that you've understood your experience well and judging that you've understood it correctly. And so you use the process even in trying to revise it when we get into it. So anyway, what he says here is simply revisers are subject to the general conditions of beginning from presentations, advancing through insights and formulations to terminate with reflections and judgments. The simple fact of the uniformity of nature in revisers, that is to say, in us, provides both logic and dialectic with an immutable ultimacy. Now, this will become more important in chapter 11, the immutable ultimacy, or the pragmatic foundation, is what we'll call it. I think that's a better term, less classicist in its connotation than immutable ultimacy. Lonergan later changes. He doesn't like to speak of anything being immutable. He'll talk about permanence rather than immutable. Okay? So within these schemes of logic and dialectic, the contextual aspect of judgment appears in three ways. Now here we get into a little bit of the hermeneutic aspect of context. There's the relation of the present to the past, the relations within the present, and the relations of the present to the future. the relation of the present to the past. The judgments that we've made in the past remain with us. They form a habitual orientation that's operative behind the scenes, that governs the direction of our attention, and that evaluates our insights, guides our formulations, influences the acceptance or rejection of new judgments. So we've got a habitual cognitive take on the world, and it's there with us. And it's a series of judgments that we have already made. And it increases as we make new judgments and as they get verified and so on and confirmed, and they stay with us, but they become part of our habitual orientation. Also, previous insights remain with us. And so when a new judgment is made, or when it's time to make a new judgment, there's already within us a habitual context of insights and other judgments. And that context stands ready perhaps to elucidate the new judgment, to complement it, to balance it, to draw distinctions, to add qualifications, to provide defense, to offer evidence or proof, to attempt persuasion, and he might have added to prevent the new judgment from emerging. Perhaps the evidence is staring you in the face, but your habitual orientation is such that you're not going to accept. So we've got the relation of a present judgment to the past. There are other judgments that we've made in the past in me. They are the habitual context within which new ones are allowed to emerge. There are relations within the present. Existing judgments may be found to conflict, and so they release the dialectical process. Again, though they do not conflict, they may not be completely independent of each other, and so they stimulate the logical effort for organized coherence. And then there's the relations of the present to the future. The questions that we answer are few compared to the questions that await an answer. Knowing is a dynamic structure, and we're oriented into the future, into the unknown. In chapter 17, he'll introduce the category of the known unknown. We know of an unknown every time we ask a question, because we know enough about it to ask a question about it. But the very fact that we're asking a question means that it's still unknown, heading into the future. And this will ground the whole notion of mystery. Opens upon the questions of religion. So the known unknown. But the questions we answer are few compared to the questions that await an answer. What each one of us knows is so minute a portion of everything about everything. And that's what remains to be known, is everything else that we don't know. Knowing is a dynamic structure. If each judgment is a total increment consisting of many parts, still it is only a minute contribution towards the whole of knowledge. But further, our knowing is dynamic in another sense. It is irretrievably habitual, for we can make but one judgment at a time, and one judgment cannot bring all we know into the full light of actual knowing. A judgment may be very comprehensive and so bear witness to the depth and breadth of our perspectives. It may be very concrete and so reveal our grasp of nuance and detail. But it cannot be both comprehensive and concrete. We'll see an example of this in Lonergan's metaphysics. His metaphysical judgments are comprehensive, and they reveal the breadth and depth of everything about everything, the heuristic structure of the universe. It will be revealed in the metaphysics or disclosed. That's his claim. I think he's right. But it's not the concrete details. That's what's known in science and common sense, not in metaphysics. Metaphysics knows the general heuristic structure, but it's science and common sense that know the concrete. All we know is somehow with us. It is present and operative within our knowing, but it lurks behind the scenes, and it reveals itself only in the exactitude with which each minor increment to our knowing is effected. The business of the human mind in this life seems to be not contemplation of what we know. That's Aristotle's God, contemplating what he/she knows, or it knows. but relentless devotion rather to the task of adding increments to a merely habitual knowledge. We want to continue to grow. Why do we continue to read? You know? Part of it is this no. We want to know more than we know already. Why do we continue to study or to go to lecture? So, because we're not satisfied with what we've got. There's more to know. All right, that's chapter 9, and we'll get into chapter 10 before we take a break. But let me see whether you've got any further questions just about judgment and its difference. That's all he was trying to do in chapter 9, is to pinpoint the difference. Okay. Yes,
John. And this partially, I guess, is leading into chapter 11, but it almost seems like there's judgment in the small and judgment in the large, where we're going to this idea about not being able to be comprehensive and concrete at the same time, that there may be some sort of need. But like I said, you can't bring everything that you know to bear. So there's this process of systematization. We're trying to fit what you've just, you know it's true, but it might change a whole bunch of things.
That's right.
So what is, that's not a cognitional process in the same way that these are?
Oh, I think it is, yeah. I mean, if you see that a new judgment, which may itself be just a minute little thing, but as you make it, you realize that maybe it's going to change some of your other take on things. And so you've got to go back and do some revision of maybe some other things and make some other new judgments. So it is all cognitional. It is. But the fact that there is judgment in the large and judgment in the small, I think you're right there. Because judgment in the small is just making that one.
That's right.
Judgment in the large is seeing this is realizing the implications that might be entailed in that one, and then seeing that perhaps it spins off into a year's work of changing everything. You know? And that happens, and that some of that's some of the best stuff that can happen to us. It's also very painful because it's the disorganization or the collapse of one way of approaching things or one way of organizing our lives, which we don't want to do. We do not want to lose the organization that we have. And of course, if we lose it all too quickly, it's traumatic. But if we can pace it, it's not. You know, it can be conversion. Breakdown. But on this thing about the comprehensive and the concrete, just to give you an example of that's what I was thinking of. What I was thinking of when I read that little section there, that a judgment may be comprehensive and reveal the breadth and depth of one's grasp of something, or it may be very concrete, but it can't be both at once. I thought of his metaphysics right away as an example of something that is comprehensive. And let me just explain just very briefly what I meant by that. Because when he gets into the chapter on metaphysics, the chapters on metaphysics, he will say that if it is true that all human, fully human knowing is a matter of experience, understanding, and judging, then what there is to be known must contain an element of what there is to be experienced, what there is to be understood, and what there is to be affirmed. And then he'll do a transposition of the Aristotelian and Thomist metaphysical categories of potency, form, and act to match that. And so what there is to be known is a complex synthesis of potency, form, and act, understood in a way that I had never understood them before, but it's a brilliant transposition of the tradition of metaphysics at that point. In terms of experiencing, understanding, and judging. And when you get it, and I'm not asking you to get all of this right now because it takes some work, but when you get it, you see that it's comprehensive of our knowing of this proportion of universe, the universe that's proportionate to to our knowing. But it's the concrete details of this, and he's very emphatic on this, are known by the sciences, not by metaphysics. This just gives you the structure. It's the sciences that know, that really know form. It's the scientific knowing of things and their relations to one another. That's what form is. And that's concrete in each instance. So it's not metaphysics that knows form. Metaphysics knows that there is form, but it doesn't know what form is. Science is another form. Physics, chemistry, biology, psychology. That's where the knowledge of form emerges concretely. Okay, it's 3 o'clock. Let's break up and then come back at about 10, and we'll probably get through chapter 10 today and leave it at that. And join the Republic to the South in Thanksgiving.